From New Mexico to Virginia, California to New Jersey, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, with violence once again raging in an American city, criminal justice reform is in the spotlight. Vikrant Reddy of the Charles Koch Institute is here with some insight. The clock is ticking. Congress faces an October 1st deadline to pass the new federal budget. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on why the process has bogged down. Unfunded pensions are a major financial problem in many large cities. Eric Boehm is joined by Jesse Hathaway of the Heartland Institute for a look at Chicago's controversial solution. And Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have tapped into a deep vein of discontent in the American electorate. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explores why and how on his American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Charlotte, North Carolina is the latest city to experience riots in the wake of a police-involved shooting. It has become a familiar story in recent months and creates renewed pressure for reforming the nation's criminal justice system. Vikrant Reddy is a senior policy analyst with the Charles Koch Institute. He joins us now to discuss efforts at reform. Vikrant, welcome to American Radio Journal. Vikrant, if we look at criminal justice reform, before we even get to talking about what reform measures need to be implemented, tell us a bit about America's criminal justice system. I know that's sort of an overly broad question, but it's been in the news a lot lately. It's been at the heart of a lot of the racial strife that we have seen, protests we have seen. What is wrong with the system? How is it broken?
I'll give you three ways in which the system is broken. The first is that it's not doing enough to ensure public safety. The second is that it simply costs too much. And then the third is that I think in certain ways we fail to appreciate it can be dehumanizing. So let's start with the first one, public safety. There's an impression that people have that guarding public safety is simple. You just take the bad guy, you pull him off the street, you put him behind bars, now the street is more safe. It's not actually quite that simple. That works up to a point, but beyond that point, it's actually counterproductive. You get diminishing returns, as an economist might say, because what happens is you grab a low-level nonviolent offender, for example, you put him behind bars next to somebody who is a serious, hardened criminal who does need to be behind bars, and that low-level nonviolent offender picks up an awful lot of bad habits. People like to say prisons are a graduate school for crime. Moreover, you have to consider what might be happening to the children of that person while they go fatherless out on the streets. You have all sorts of terrible ways in which our criminal justice system, which is so incarceration-focused, may be causing more crime than it stops. So you've got that public safety component, first of all. The second part of it is the cost issue. I'm from Texas, and in my home state, putting somebody behind bars for a day costs $50. Putting somebody on probation for a day costs $2.99. It's an enormous gulf, that difference. We're not talking about the difference between $3 and $4. We're talking about the difference between $3 and $50. And I think anybody, even the most hard-nosed fiscal conservative, would say, look, for people who belong behind bars, hardened violent criminals, I'll bite down and sign the $50 check. If that's what it takes, that's what it takes. But for people who don't belong behind bars, people who are first-time offenders, who are nonviolent offenders, low-level, this kind of thing, it's really just fiscally irresponsible to be spending $50 a day rather than $3 a day. And then the final component, this notion that I floated earlier that the criminal justice system is dehumanizing, I think that's really a question of human dignity. It's something that a lot of libertarians, a lot of social conservatives, interestingly, catch on to immediately. They'll say, when I talk to them, there's something Orwellian feeling about seeing so many Americans locked up behind bars and cages. There's something awful about what's happening to communities where a third of all the fathers are locked up behind bars, and you know that the families and the neighborhoods are just deteriorating for this reason. We've got to find a better way to handle these offenders, find a way to handle them in the community, sanction them, don't get me wrong. I want to make sure that people are held accountable for doing wrong, but we've got to find a better way to do that. Prison is not always the best route.
As we look at offenders who end up behind bars, we see that very frequently it's something that it's almost hereditary. You see grandparents, parents, children, grandchildren, one after another, finding themselves generation after generation in trouble with the law. Is there any thought being given to how we break that cycle?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. The last figure I saw is that if you have a parent behind bars, you yourself have a 70% likelihood of ending up behind bars. That's to say nothing of your diminished chances of high school graduation, your increased likelihood to abuse drugs, your increased likelihood of teen pregnancy, all of these various kinds of dysfunctions. And there is a lot of thought being given to those kinds of things. And most of the best research suggests that what you've got to do is, if possible, take the offender and supervise them in the community. This means better probation, better parole, drug courts, mental health courts, and veterans courts. These are different institutions where the court will work with the person to get past the problem they've got, the drug addiction, the alcohol addiction. And if they're done well, they're tough. They're holding people accountable. It's a lot tougher than prison, where sometimes you're just kind of told to sit behind these bars, hang out, and watch television. Instead, in these drug courts and these stronger probation programs, you were told, listen, you've got a victim. We're going to make sure that you keep a job and you earn money to pay restitution to that victim. We're going to make sure you go to work, and we're going to make sure you take care of your kids, and we're going to make sure you kick your drug addiction. Those kinds of things, I think, are actually tough on crime, and they get better results, and they help break that cycle that you're talking about.
I've noticed that when we talk about this issue, it seems to be high on the agenda of the political left. It seems to be high on the agenda of the political right. And amazing, I'm hearing a lot of the same concerns and proposed solutions to the problem. Are you seeing a coming together to actually get something done on this issue?
It's a really weird issue, Loman, and that's because the two sides are not coming together in the sense that we traditionally think of when we say political compromise. So somebody says, look, I'll give in a little here, you give in a little there, and we'll meet in the middle and pass our broader goals. Instead, what's happening is that they're speaking totally different languages, totally different vocabulary being used. And conservatives are appealing to their base with the language of Orwellian dehumanization, excessively high costs, not doing enough to promote public safety. Meanwhile, progressives are appealing to their base with a lot of language about things like racial disparities, for example. And yet, even though people are speaking totally different languages and emphasizing completely different issues, they're nevertheless ending up in the same place.
We have been talking with Vikrant Reddy, who is a senior research fellow at the Charles Koch Institute. And Vikrant, could you tell us a bit about the Charles Koch Institute, what you do, and hopefully we've piqued the interest of some folks. So where can they go on the web to learn more about criminal justice reform?
Sure. They can go to charleskochinstitute.org. We are a 501c3 nonprofit based in Arlington, Virginia. We're primarily a school, and we have all sorts of interesting educational programs for students and young professionals that help introduce people to concepts and ideas in classical liberalism, or libertarianism, you might also call it. And like any other kind of school, we've got people who work on policy issues. So we've focused on these issues, and we've got people who write and research and speak publicly on these matters. And my issue area is criminal justice reform.
Vikrant Reddy, who is Senior Research Fellow at the Charles Koch Institute. Vikrant, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed being on today.
Andy Roth is at the offices of the Club for Growth. Congress is in session. So, Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Been busy keeping an eye on everything going on with Congress. And Andy, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the fact that the federal budget deadline was approaching. We thought it would be a relatively brief return for Congress, what with elections coming up in just a couple of weeks. But they're still there. What's going on?
They're still very much anxious to get back to their homes and their districts and their states in order to campaign, because the balance of power in the Senate, certainly, and then obviously in the White House, and then maybe in the House, but I think the House should be fine. They're all up in the air, so they're ready to start campaigning, but they've got this little federal budget problem that they've got to deal with, and they don't know what to do. They can't pass the actual budget, so instead they're trying to pass a continuing resolution, which is just one monster bill that kind of says, let's keep everything going on autopilot. It's a horrible way to legislate, but they've been doing it every year for several years now. So as we speak, they're bickering over the details, and Harry Reid is a master negotiator, and Republicans historically seem to cave on things. So I have a cynical view on how this is going to end, but it hasn't ended yet. Now, the fiscal year ends on September 30th, which is just days away, and that's their hard deadline. They have to pass something by then, or the government shuts down. What I believe will happen is that they will pass a CR, a continuing resolution, before then. It will have some very horrible things in it, and the CR will expire purposely in a lame duck, so like December 8th. So after the elections, when a lot of these members will either have been fired or are no longer returning to office, they will be returning to office for this lame duck session. So they'll have zero accountability from the taxpayers, and they will be voting on December 8th or December 9th for trillions of dollars of more spending. And that's a horrible way to legislate. So we're in a bad spot right now, and I hope that the elections may change that, but it doesn't seem likely right now.
This issue of Congress coming back and doing this vote in the lame duck session, Andy, is that cast in stone at this point, or is there still a chance they might just pass the continuing resolution into January and let the new Congress deal with it?
I suppose there's always a chance, but every incentive for the big spenders in Washington who control things, every incentive is for them to schedule a lame duck. There are always those pesky tax extenders that come up every year, and Congress always deals with them at the very last moment. They have to deal with that. And then there's a whole host of other things that they kind of want to deal with at the very last moment. It may be funding for Zika. The Democrats still want background checks for guns. There might be some negotiations between Republicans and Obama on his judicial selections. There's all these things that somehow, for some reason, politicians think that they should wait till the very last moment to deal with. And I think a lot of it is the accountability. They want to pass things with as very little accountability as possible. And when you have a lame duck session, a lot of these members aren't coming back into office, so they're not accountable. And those who are coming back to office, they're doing it at the furthest point from the next election. So they're hoping that, voters will forget all the mischief that they created so far long ago from what will be the 2018 elections. So it's nasty stuff, but that's what they're doing.
As we look at this process, and it continues to unfold with this deadline of a week or so from now, October 1st, there are some interesting maneuvers taking place that sort of add a bit to the shadiness of it. Can you tell us a bit about this?
The regular budget process is divided into 12 or 13 appropriations bills, and each bill is supposed to be considered on the floor of the House and on the floor of the Senate. There's supposed to be vigorous debate, amendments considered, and then the bill passes. This is supposed to be the healthy way of doing business. But with continuing resolutions, there aren't 13 bills. There are very likely no amendments, so the voice of the people is not heard in these debates. It is simply an up or down vote on the continuing resolution. And since everyone knows that this big monster bill is considered a must-pass bill, then what politicians do is try and lump on more things, more extraneous things. Right now, there's a debate over whether there should be a tweak to the Export-Import Bank's bylaws so that they can get around some restrictions on approving loans. That may seem like a minor thing, but that's what they're trying to shove into this bill. Then they're trying to shove in the Zika funding. And then there's a debate over whether we should pay for the Zika funding. If we're going to spend billions of dollars for Zika, it seems very reasonable that we should cut spending elsewhere in order to pay for it. But that's another debate that's being managed, and I suspect at the end of the day they won't pay for it because they historically don't pay for it. But it's all these little ticky-tack little things that they're currently debating about, and that's what's elongating this process or stretching it out to the very end. It's almost like a game of chicken to see how much you can pile on before it's time to stop.
And there's a little bit of you have to pass the bill to know what's in the bill going on?
Yeah, no, this is the worst. The thing that's the most frustrating is that because of Senate rules, you really have to get moving on debate well in advance of a deadline. And the Senate, earlier this week, had a motion to proceed to the CR. What's interesting here is that the CR doesn't exist yet. They were still debating it. So they proceeded to a bill, a motion to debate a bill that doesn't even exist. And it rings true what Nancy Pelosi said about Obamacare, is that we have to pass it to know what's in it. And that's precisely what they're doing here.
We have been talking with Andy Roth from the Club for Growth. And Andy, tell us just a bit about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 100,000 members from all across the country, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
The city of Chicago is looking to water and sewer ratepayers to help solve its public pension crisis. For details, Eric Boehm talks with Jesse Hathaway of the Heartland Institute.
People in Chicago pay for their water and sewer services just like people everywhere else do, but starting next year, residents of Chicago might see themselves getting hit twice for the same service. They're going to still pay for their water and sewer, but then there's going to be a new tax on top of those payments, and that tax, you probably won't be surprised to learn, isn't going to pay for anything that has anything to do with the water and sewer infrastructure in Chicago. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Radio. Thanks so much for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Jesse Hathaway. He is a research fellow at the Heartland Institute in Chicago. He's been following the ongoing mess of the Chicago pension systems and this latest attempt to try in some small way to solve it. Jesse, thanks so much for taking some time and joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show today, Eric.
Glad to have you. People in Chicago are going to see a much larger bill for their water and sewer services starting next year, but that money that they're paying isn't really going to help them get, you know, I don't know, more water or better infrastructure or anything like that.
Absolutely right, and unfortunately that is an accurate description. This currently proposed tax hike, it's about a 29.5 or 30, if you want to round it up, percent increase. And so the average Chicago resident is going to see their water bill go up by about $53 per year. As you mentioned, this additional tax is going to go to the Municipal Employees Annuity and Benefit Fund, which is one of the four public government pension plans there in the city of Chicago. This particular plan is otherwise expected to go bankrupt and within the next 10 years or so. Currently, the fund is roughly 32% funded, meaning that they have enough assets on hand to pay 32 cents on every dollar that the fund owes or that it will owe in the future.
So the city says that they need to have this new tax on water and sewer, essentially just to transfer money into the pension fund. But as you already said, Jesse, it's going to go bankrupt, or it's currently on pace to go bankrupt in less than a decade anyway. Is this just going to keep it alive for a little bit longer, or is this an actual real long-term solution to the pension problem?
Well, because of the way that many government pension plans do their books, It's the latter situation. It's going to take about 50 years for the pension plan to fill up. It's actually not even going to fill up completely. It's going to be filled up by 2057 to about 90 cents on the dollar. That's, however, that assumes that the fund's investments will be earning 7.5% back every year, year after year, for the next 50 years. The one way to help people think of it, the absurdity of this assumption, is that the lawmakers in Chicago are going to be assuming that they are about twice as good at playing at the stock market as the best private sector stockbrokers. In the private sector, if you went to a stockbroker and said, I want to make 7.5% a year after year, they would laugh at you and tell you to get out of their office because, realistically speaking, the best stock investors only can only promise or guarantee about 3% annually. So lawmakers are saying they're about twice as smart as anyone else in the world of stock investing.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking to Jesse Hathaway. He's a research fellow with the Heartland Institute in Chicago. And Jesse, even though we're talking about Chicago specifically here and the pension problems there, I mean, this is really a national story because pension plans in cities and states all over this country have these same unrealistic high expectations where they think they're going to earn 7-8% every year in perpetuity. And they're also, in many cases, deeply underfunded, maybe not in as bad of shape as where Chicago is, but there's a lot of other pension plans out there that are pretty close, or at least are also struggling. Given the options here, I mean, look, this money is owed to people. This money's been promised, probably shouldn't have been, but it was. Taxpayers, at the end of the day, are going to get hit one way or another, right? Chicago's putting this fee on water and sewer. What other options really are there for people to try and get out from under, for cities to try and get out from under these huge obligations?
Well, there is one thing that would, wouldn't help taxpayers now, but it would help taxpayers down the road. And that's creating what's called defined contribution plans. Your listeners might know defined contribution plans by a simpler name, which is probably the 401k plan that they have at their job in the private sector. Moving people, or at least allowing people to move into these plans when they're hired as government workers, wouldn't solve the problem now, but it would solve the problem for future generations. Defined benefit plans are a transfer of wealth from one generation to the other. It's kicking the can down the road.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're doing here, and that's exactly what's been happening in Chicago and lots of other places where right now, look, this pension plan is on pace to go bankrupt in 10 years, right? Nobody who's putting the money in there as today, anybody who's getting money taken out of their paycheck and deposited into that pension plan, I don't know why they would assume that money is going to be there if the plan's going to go bankrupt in 10 years. Even these new taxes at this point, you know, what doesn't Chicago tax at this point that then they still can't seem to make ends meet with this pension plan? It's a story that's playing out in lots of places, playing out perhaps most acutely in some big cities like Chicago. Thanks for taking some time and joining us.
All right. Thank you for having me on.
Once again, that's Jesse Hathaway from the Heartland Institute. You can check out all of their work online at heartland.org. For Reason Radio, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out my latest story on Chicago's pension disaster and why this new tax won't fix the problem at Reason.com. We'll see you next week right back here on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Why are elites so afraid of presidential candidates like Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and Bernie Sanders? Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has the answer on this American Radio Journal commentary.
When I see that Wall Street and the power brokers are placing their bets on Hillary Clinton with donations to her campaign, as well as the unsavory pay-to-play of the Clinton Foundation and the State Department under Hillary Clinton, I become skeptical of the motives of those in the establishment, the elite, as much as I disdain that word. Why Hillary rather than their member of their own financial elite? Why? My skepticism is that perhaps our sensibilities are under assault. The acclaimed author Dr. Seuss wrote about the Sneetches and the analogy of the dispute between those with stars and those without stars, and the financial gain that was made by adding stars and removing stars upon theirs. Are we the Sneetches? Are we being played by the political elite to battle one another rather than to take on the system, to force the system to finally serve the people who elected them? I've spent my entire adult life in this system. I'm a retired Marine Reserve colonel. In 2016, I won the primary election for the State House of Representatives seat in Pennsylvania. At age 65, I decided to make a difference. In my lifetime, I've been very fortunate to be on both sides of our society, meaning those who have done well and those who have not. I started out in a very poor family after our dad passed away, leaving our mom with five children and little income. In my success, I've seen the other side of the tracks. The establishment lives differently than you and I. They have the proverbial stars upon theirs. They live differently, but it's clear that we are not one of them. Those of us born on the wrong side of the track struggled to do well and help our children succeed so that our children could experience a better life. Our parents wanted the American dream for our children, and it was attainable. I'm an example. With that as a background, I noticed during this election cycle when I was going door to door in my campaign that there were not significant differences between those who supported Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and Ted Cruz. They were all disenchanted with the system, albeit in different ways. Their anger was somewhat haphazardly organized, but it was not as different as one might think. So when I read the establishment disdain for Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, and to a lesser extent Bernie Sanders, I wonder if it is because the establishment realizes that perhaps the sole survivor, Donald Trump, might be wise to their game. For example, so many of our laws, and in particular our tax code, are geared to protect the elite and the establishment at the expense of those trying to get ahead. The media, to a large extent, the American people, have successfully accepted the fantasy that surrounds the debate about the unfair tax code. Unfortunately, the debate is centered in two absolutely flawed assumptions. The first assumption is that to cure the wealth gap between the richest and the poorest of society, increasing income taxes will solve the problem. The second assumption is that the deficit can only be cured by raising taxes rather than cutting spending. Both Democrats and Republicans in office have an incentive to keep the debate going about income inequality as being the culprit. While the public at large seems to relish getting into the debate of raising or not raising taxes on income, the various wealthiest of supporters of both parties know that by keeping us distracted about income taxes, their wealth will remain intact. Liberals and conservatives, better yet, anyone of substantial wealth, uses tax shelters. Just ask Donald Trump. If this very wealthy population can keep us distracted on income inequality, they never have to be concerned about their ruse being uncovered. One way to keep us distracted is to make the tax code so complicated that no one can understand the discussion. Candidly, it is simpler for the media to describe the argument as taxing income. In reality, then, is this tremendous anger at Donald Trump and previously Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders because they understand the game of the establishment and plan to end the star upon theirs perks and privileges? Is the disdain of the establishment against Donald Trump now the sole survivor really because the game may be up if he is elected? Unfortunately, I don't know Donald Trump's real motives. I wish I did. But I do have to question that when many people of similar wealth are against him, are they rebelling against a traitor to their cause, which is the protection of the establishment at our expense? Perhaps the establishment is fearful that the Coliseum that they have been having us all play is going to be turned on them and the game will be up. Perhaps in this election, Pokemon Go will give way to establishment gone. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on over 200 public affairs-minded radio stations in 45 states across the country. They include WING-AM and WQNZ-AM in Dayton, Ohio, along with KGVO-AM in Missoula, Montana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.